Welcome to the Baptist Health Doc-to-Doc podcast, a conversation for physicians by physicians, providing insight on the latest in medical practice, research, technology, and innovation in healthcare. Join Baptist Health experts as they offer practical advice for clinicians covering a wide range of specialties. Cancer, neuroscience, orthopedics, and cardiovascular care are just some of the timely discussions you'll find right here on the Doc-to-Doc podcast.
Hello, I'm Steve Hoff, board-certified cardiac and thoracic surgeon at Baptist Health Miami Cardiac and Vascular Institute. I specialize in adult cardiac surgery, and I'm a fellow of the Heart Rhythm Society with a special interest in the surgical treatment of arrhythmias.
And I'm Mario Pasquale, an electrophysiologist with Baptist Health and Miami Cardiac and Vascular Institute. I specialize in diagnosing arrhythmias and treating heart rhythm disorders.
Welcome to the third part of our AFib series. In the first part, we covered the advent of technologies and treatments for atrial fibrillation over the past century. In the second part of our series, we discussed the modern guideline-directed approaches to the treatment of atrial fibrillation that included both medical therapy, catheter-based therapy, surgical, and hybrid therapies. In this episode, we'll be examining the guideline-directed therapies and current options for the left atrial appendage management, and then we'll move forward to discuss what lies ahead in promising developments offering brilliant and never-imagined solutions in the treatment of atrial fibrillation. So, Mario, let's start with left atrial appendage management. Give us your thoughts about the current options and the discussion that you would have with patients regarding isolated left atrial appendage management, who you might have that conversation with, the options that are available currently, the risks that go along with those, and the impact on anticoagulation strategies.
Absolutely. And, Steve, on our previous podcast, we had mentioned, our biggest concern with AFib is actually not the arrhythmia itself, but really one of the consequences, and that's the risk of stroke. And, we talked a little bit about the anticoagulants, which have truly been instrumental in preventing stroke and blood clot formation in atrial fibrillation. But, unfortunately, many patients can't tolerate it. And there's many different reasons why a patient couldn't tolerate anticoagulation. I think probably the most common reason that we see is just bleeding. Many patients have a propensity to bleed, or they have certain medical conditions, especially within the intestines, within the GI tract, that will predispose them to bleeding. And bleeding can be quite uncomfortable and many times can be life-threatening. And our biggest life-threatening bleed is actually within the brain, and our intracranial hemorrhages. We know, and every neurosurgeon and neurologist's biggest concern with anticoagulants is actually the risk of intracranial hemorrhage, because they know how bad the outcomes are in any patient with an intracranial hemorrhage. And so in these patients, that's when we really begin to consider and think about alternatives to anticoagulation. We know the majority of blood clots come within the left atrial appendage itself. And we know the left atrial appendage is a funny structure, and it has very many different kind of shapes and forms to it. And some of those names, pretty funny. There's the chicken wing, there's the cactus, there's the windsock. And so a lot of different morphologies to the left atrial appendage. And so we've had to come up with multiple different devices that can actually occlude that appendage in order to offer these patients an alternative to anticoagulation. So really, anyone who can't tolerate anticoagulation should really be screened for what we call left atrial appendage occlusion. So if we can exclude the left atrial appendage, then we can get rid of the area or the structure within the heart where the vast majority of blood clots can form. And endocardially or percutaneously from the inside out, we have three main options. That's the Watchman, the Amulet, and the Lariat device. And there's an Amplatzer device that has really been kind of transitioned to the Amulet device at this point. And so depending on the anatomy of the left atrial appendage, each device will be better seated in these patients in order to have it done. And like any procedure, I think the beauty of it is, number one, is our procedure safety has never been better. So if we look at our outcomes after this procedure, our risk of any type of, you know, perforation or damage to the heart muscle is less than 1%. Most recent Watchman data came out at 0.3% intra-procedural risk for that procedure. And we know that more than 99% of patients are able to get off of their anticoagulation within the first 6 weeks after left atrial appendage occlusion. So I think we're certainly improving. I think we have now an excellent option for these patients as alternatives to anticoagulation. But our limitation is that we also know that the left atrial appendage contributes to atrial fibrillation and can definitely be a trigger for atrial fibrillation. And so our devices actually prevent the need for long-term anticoagulation and offer a good alternative, but we don't. Our devices don't electrically isolate the appendage, which can definitely have a good antiarrhythmic effect. And that's where I'll kind of throw it back at you, because I know your devices can not just isolate, but they do a little bit more. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the epicardial options, Steve?
Sure. So we know that Manning's left atrial appendage, and I appreciate your thoughts about the morphology. I agree with you completely. I've seen thousands of them in my career. I call it the cardiac fingerprint. I've never seen two the same. But because of all the nooks and crannies in that thing, that's where the blood clots tend to form. So removing the appendage from the circulation is an important strategy. So the surgical management of the left atrial appendage starts with some of the history that we talked about in episode one. When Dr. Cox developed the Mays procedure, he included both mechanically removing the left atrial appendage from the circulation and electrically isolating it to remove those triggers that can cause atrial fibrillation or atrial flutter in the appendage. And so we have now currently two devices on the market, one that's brand new, the other that's been on the market for, you know, at least 10 years. The nice thing about these devices is that they're not only very effective at excluding the left atrial appendage from the circulation, but they're all electrically competent. So what they do is basically create the same thing that Dr. Cox intended with the Mays procedure, and that is electrically isolate the appendage and mechanically isolate the appendage from the circulation. The way that I now our role, in my opinion, for isolated left atrial appendage management has been diminished over the years based on improvement in the technologies of endocardial devices. So, you know, in the first iteration of the Watchman device, there were a great many people that failed screening because of anatomical issues. 10-15% had short appendages and that sort of thing. Risk of perforation was high. And so we saw more patients who were referred for standalone left atrial appendage management epicardially with an epicardial device. I think now with the second generation of Watchman and the other options that you mentioned, that screen failure number drops dramatically. But there are still certainly patients primarily who just can't tolerate any anticoagulation, even the 6 weeks of anticoagulation that are now recommended, dramatically less than what we started with, you know, with the first iteration of the Watchman device when it was a year. So there are still patients in whom consideration can be given to an epicardial procedure. The nice thing about that is because the device is epicardial, there's nothing inside the space to theoretically be thrombogenic, and we typically do not treat patients with anticoagulation at all postoperatively. Usually this is an operation can be done through a left thoracoscopy. It takes about 20 or 30 minutes to do, extremely safe and extremely effective. The latter is an important consideration because, you know, one of the things that we've learned from surgery the hard way is sometimes as surgeons, we've not done as good a job as possible over the years to completely ligate the appendage. And an incompletely ligated appendage is arguably worse than a patent left atrial appendage. So to be sure that the device is in the right place, I tell people that there are two modes of failure. There's leaks around a device and an incomplete closure of the device, or leaving what we would call a stump of appendage that theoretically could still form blood clots. So with an effectively placed device, the thromboembolic risk drops dramatically. And it's been, I think really very effective. And obviously, we consider left atrial appendage management in the setting of AFib ablation during other heart surgery, a really important piece. One of the other things, last things I'll mention about the surgery part is actually one of the things that we could theoretically get into, but I think we'll talk about it now, and that is what's in the future for the surgical aspects of left atrial appendage. One of the questions that we intend to answer, and in fact, here at Miami Cardiac and Vascular Institute, we are actively enrolling in a clinical trial to answer this question. The left atrial appendage is such a devastating anatomical structure. If you're having heart surgery for any reason, should you leave the operating room without a left atrial appendage? Because of the risk of thromboembolism and the rest, the risk of getting atrial fibrillation, as a part of the natural healing process after heart surgery. And we're actually enrolling in an international clinical trial to help answer that question. So we hope that that'll be a question that, will be answered in the next 5 years. And we're excited about contributing to that. So, so I think that's a little bit about how we look at this surgically. So let's change direction just a little bit, Mario. And
ask you one question before.
Sure, fire away.
I think probably the most common question I get, Stephen, I'd be interested in your protocol is, after any type of endocardial ablation, we have a kind of protocol to make sure that the device is well seated and there's no concerning findings, 3 months later, whether that's a TE or a CT scan. One of the common questions I get from many cardiology colleagues is after a surgical clip, is there any protocol or how should we feel confident stopping that patient's anticoagulation?
That's a great question. So we talked a little bit about the mode of failure of those epicardial devices. And our experience has been, and we've been fortunate enough to publish data about the efficacy of epicardial clip devices. And what we've seen is once they're on, they don't move. So that's a really important thing, I think, to be sure that people know about. So procedural success can be measured pretty immediately. And really, the need for follow-up studies is really probably not necessary. So when we do this, with TE-directed study in the operating room and basically, apply the device and then look at it with TEE. If we're not happy with it, the nice thing is the device can actually be reopened, repositioned, and then restudied. Okay. So as long as we're leaving the operating room with complete occlusion of left atrial appendage and no mode of failure, gap or a stump, then we're confident that the left atrial appendage is managed. Now, the larger question, I believe, is technically not unanswered. So if you look at the guidelines for anticoagulation strategy, they really don't mention what you should do in the case of a completely occluded left atrial appendage. And I think this becomes a little bit the art of medicine. So those of us who are aggressive about managing the left atrial appendage believe that with an epicardial device that's well placed or an endocardial device that has the opportunity to endothelialize, that the thromboembolic risk is so low that the need for anticoagulation is probably obviated because the risk of bleeding outweighs the risk of thromboembolism. Mm-hmm. The guidelines haven't really caught up with that thought yet. So I think that may be for the future as the people that help make these decisions look at the data and can help guide us with regard to what's safest and when can we stop anticoagulation. But right now, for the surgical clips, what we've seen is the left atrial appendage is adequately managed at the time of surgery, we feel confident that the risk of thromboembolism is dramatically low. Now, in the face of ablation, we still anticoagulate because of the risk of those ablation lines being a nidus for thromboembolism. So, you know, it depends a little bit on the mode. So I think that that's the way on the surgery side that we look at that. Do you feel differently with the endocardial devices?
No, I think, you know, guidelines are, you know, I think we have more specific protocols in that we always take a look 6 weeks in. And, you know, the reason is, you know, I think with all of our devices, just like you said, we initially implant the device, but our best outcomes occur once the body endothelializes and forms a nice kind of well-covered scar over those devices. Then at that point, we feel much more assured that there's no communication between the left atrial appendage and the systemic circulation, and we can stop anticoagulation. You know, now there's certainly a risk of what we call peri-device leaks, and we see it about 1-2% of the time. So, you know, from that standpoint, we're just learning how to manage these peri-device leaks. The management of these peri-device leaks has changed over the last couple of years. And I think from our standpoint, that's where the future of our research and where our guidelines are going to take us is, you know, how do we define these peri-device leaks? When do we continue or when do we stop anticoagulation? And how do we go and fix these devices, these leaks, which we have a couple of options to do.
That's great. And now, so let's move on to kind of what the future holds. And while we're talking about the left atrial appendage, is there anything else that you know about on the horizon, device-related improvements in the current devices that are in the hopper that we might expect to see over the next, say, 5 years?
Yeah, there's a couple of actually. So there's, you know, we're trying to find out the best way to isolate the appendage. And similar to what you guys do, the AtriClip device, the best way to isolate an appendage, I think, is to get rid of an appendage. And so there's a couple of procedures out there where they look not only to fill in the appendage, but actually to be able to almost apply a suture from the inside out. That trial is just getting started now, so it'll be a couple of years before we look at that data. There's also actually a couple of foams. So it's a device where it has kind of a basket sitting in front, and then you inject the foam, and that foam kind of takes over the morphology of the appendage. The nice thing being, as you said, every appendage is different. You know, with a foam injection, that can conform to every appendage. So not as worried anymore about the appendage morphology itself and being an appropriate candidate for a procedure. So, you know, definitely exciting times. There's a lot of momentum in terms of left atrial appendage management and certainly looking forward to what the future is going to hold in the next 2 or 3 years here.
Now, on the surgery side, I would say that the biggest opportunities for us will be about making placement of an epicardial device even less invasive. The ability to manage the left atrial appendage at the time of less invasive cardiac surgery. You know, we do a lot of valve surgery through small little incisions now rather than big incisions down the breastbone. Similarly with bypass surgery, the same thing. And the ability to manage the left atrial appendage effectively from the outside during these minimally invasive procedures will be an opportunity for us to continue to evolve technologically over the next 5 or 10 years, I suspect.
Yeah, excellent.
So is there any, let's you know, explore some of the other topics that we've talked about and think about kind of the future. Anything on the horizon, say, with medical therapy as far as new antiarrhythmic drugs or anticoagulants that we might hear about on the evening news over the next 5 years or so that might change therapy for AFib?
Yeah, so, you know, to be frank, we're really excited about a new anticoagulant coming out, what we call Factor 11 inhibitor. And, you know, we had a lot of hope that these medications would actually be superior to a pretty well-performing, you know, medication, and we use the direct oral anticoagulants. And unfortunately, the data has not supported that just yet. It was actually inferior in preventing thromboembolic events. Superior in terms of safety, so certainly less bleeding, but you know, initial results seem not to be as promising as what we would hope for, as we were hoping for. So not a lot in terms of anticoagulants right now, but you know, we'll see. You know, the companies are definitely doing their research out there, and there's a lot to understand about the coagulation cascade and which steps in that complex process to inhibit in order to prevent blood clot formation.
I would say that's true, and certainly the motivation for companies to try to develop new therapies, both medical therapies for as antiarrhythmic drugs or anticoagulation, is the millions and millions of people worldwide that would benefit from that.
Yeah.
Well, let's shift gears then and talk a little bit about a topic that you and I have spoken about before and observed recently. I think one of the most exciting things coming down the line as far as therapies have to do with new endocardial ablation technologies. And you and I have had the opportunity to explore some of these in Europe. Interestingly, since our last session, now FDA approved in the United States. So tell us a little bit about pulse field ablation and the differences compared to some of the options that we have with current endocardial ablation strategies and what we've seen from the European data and their experience over the last few years with its use.
Yeah. So, you know, you're exactly right. EPs in the United States couldn't be happier that we finally got the FDA's approval to start using pulse field ablation here at Miami Cardiac and Vascular Institute. We expect our first patient will probably be within the next 4 weeks or so. So we couldn't be more excited. And, you know, right now our standard ablation techniques involve either some type of thermal energy, whether that's heat thermal energy or cryo energy, which is great. And I think we've had great outcomes. And I think our procedures have never been safer using one of those energy fields. But now comes in pulse field ablation. Pulse field ablation is a very specific energy waveform to myocardial tissue. So they've been able to figure out that if you deliver energy in a specific waveform, you can eliminate or cause, you know, cell death very specifically in the endocardium, in the myocardium of the heart, but not cause any type of damage or changes in other structures that are very near the heart. So we've talked about the beauty of ablation is that it works, and it quickly works to eliminate heart tissue and abnormally conducting cells. The problem is you can have things like the phrenic nerve or the esophagus very nearby that if you deliver enough heat or cold energy, you can cause things like esophageal ulcers, which definitely make EPs nervous. By delivering pulse field energy, we can rest assured that it's very specific to the endocardium or the myocardium, and we're not causing any damage to nearby structures such as the phrenic nerve or the esophagus, meaning we believe we can deliver much more effective lesions in this area because we are not going to be limited by the damage which can be caused to other structures surrounding the heart. And I think that's a real game changer, because I think if we look right now at the number one cause of why our ablations fail, it is likely because we are having a lot of difficulty ablating near areas that are limited by the esophagus or the phrenic nerve. Just can't do it, because the least thing you want to do is cause harm to any patient. So you have to be very cautious. If we can get a combination of having a pulse field ablation and another type of energy source, then I think we're really going to be having very, you know, really great outcomes long term. And pulse field ablation does an excellent job of isolating the pulmonary veins, which we know are our most common trigger for atrial fibrillation. So if we can do that safely and we can do it effectively, then I think we can also kind of expand the patient population we offer this therapy to. Right now, it is still a procedure under general anesthesia. I think, you know, delivering either cryo energy or thermal energy, patients can have sometimes a little tough time recovering, especially the first 3 to 4 days. These energy deliver this energy causes a lot of inflammation. Many patients can get some chest pain or what we call pericarditis after the procedure. The beauty of PFA is it causes no pericarditis. And because it is a more efficient procedure and likely a safer procedure, we may not even need general anesthesia. A lot of these patients can be done under moderate sedation. So as you expand and become more efficient at something, as you improve the safety of a procedure, you can open it up to certain patient populations that maybe right now are not best suited by, you know, general anesthesia and kind of a tough recovery. Kind of, you know, our elderly patient population, they have a tough time tolerating general anesthesia. You know, pericarditis in an 85-year-old is very different than in a 55-year-old. And so we may be able to also expand our indications for AFib ablation with this new energy source that we're going to be able to offer, you know, very soon. So, you know, definitely they've been using it in Europe for about 3 to 5 years. And I'll tell you, if you talk to any electrophysiologist, they probably haven't done thermal ablation in quite some time now, ever since PFA came out, because they're just extremely happy with the results. Patients are extremely happy with their success and their recovery from these procedures. And, you know, we couldn't be, you know, more excited to start using this new technology here at Miami Cardiac and Vascular Institute.
So let me ask you a question then, as it pertains to the future of surgical ablation. Has there been any experience, or do you have any idea in the people that you've talked to that have used PFA over the last few years with ablating with the blood pool and potentially using this as an epicardial device? So, you know, the nice thing about endocardial ablation is you don't have to worry so much about the blood pool being a sink for either the heat or the cold that you're delivering. For surgical ablation on the outside of the heart, that's an enormous problem, because as we talked about in our first episode, both of us are interested in trying to make sure that the injury that we create and the scar that the patient then ends up with, which is ultimately going to be what's going to keep them in regular rhythm, needs to be all the way through the thickness of the myocardium. So are you aware of any limitations from a heat sink problem with the endocardial blood pool? And could we look for PFA to possibly be a part of surgical epicardial ablation in the future?
I think so. And I think the biggest limitation of PFA right now is it is very tissue specific. And by making it very tissue specific, that also means that if you have different tissue thickness, we also have to change the energy source. And so delivering PFA in the posterior wall is not going to be the same as the type of PFA or pulse field ablation delivered on the anterior side of the atrium. It is not going to be the same energy delivery in the appendage. It is definitely not going to be the same energy delivery in the left ventricle. So I think the future of pulse field ablation, and I think it'll be the same in the epicardium, is how to determine what waveform to use depending on the patient's anatomy. And as you know, and probably, you know, more experienced, is every patient anatomy is very different. And so understanding that tissue wall thickness before the procedure will be huge for us in really fine-tuning pulse field ablation and getting the best outcomes for our patients.
Yeah. Well, I think that we both agree that PFA has the ability, will have the ability, and I think our colleagues in Europe have seen it, that it's going to change the way that, you know, we talk about ablation. And, you know, as it pertains to the future, I even think that, you know, I suspect that in the United States, research trials and, you know, hybrid therapies and that sort of thing are going to largely look at PFA-based ablation strategies. And that's really going to be the future of what we do over the next at least 5, if not 10 years, as it pertains to treating not only atrial fibrillation, but theoretically other heart rhythm disturbances.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Stephen. And there is a lot of public data being published already in Europe. And there's a lot of interest in, again, kind of going to that next level of PFA in terms of how do you dial in for each, for a more patient specific therapy as opposed to a broad therapy for each patient. So, you know, if we look at the number of trials of PFA going on right now, it almost seems like, you know, there's a new paper being published every week in regards to paroxysmal AFib, persistent AFib, VT ablation. And, you know, we're excited about it.
Well, to say that the future looks bright with regard to atrial fibrillation is an underestimate. And I, as we've just stated, I think the future is here in the United States, at least for the next decade. The acceleration of these treatment techniques, methods, and even some of the pharmacologic things you've talked about give us tremendous hope that one day this very difficult problem will have a simple and straightforward treatment. Certainly the field of innovation continues, and with the hope of, future strategies, we look forward to treating patients better and better as the years go on. So Mario, want to thank you for your insight over these episodes. As usual, I've enjoyed talking with you about one of our favorite topics, and thanks again for your input.
Absolutely, Steve. Thanks so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it, and I couldn't be more excited about the future. And I think, you know, the combined approach between EPs and CT surgeons will only continue to evolve and get better. And it's an exciting time to be involved in arrhythmia care.
Very good. Well, everybody, as far as our audience is concerned, we appreciate you being with us, and we look forward to doing more of this in the future. So thank you very much.
To find out more about the topics covered on the Doc to Doc podcast, please visit physicianresources.baptisthealth.net.